This is Colorful Radio.
Talk, and we are live with Sir Lenny Henry. Woo! Thank you. And yes, I know all of you our regular audience listening in right now on Colourful Radio. I know you're thinking, what are you doing here? You're normally only there on a Tuesday. But this is very, very special because, of course, we have a live audience. We could not keep them away. And I am Jacqueline Malcolm, your host. But, of course, as you always know, there is always a pixie in the room.
Oh, there is always a pixie in the room.
But as you can see why Pixie is not going to be on the mic. Because...
Give her a chance.
Oh, no, she isn't.
Oh, yes, she is.
Oh, no, she isn't.
Oh, yes, she is.
That's... Oh, look at this. Look at you. You got a following. You got a following, Pixie. Okay, but before we go, are we in for a good time tonight, Pixie?
Yes, we are. We always are. It's Jabber Talk.
It is Jabber Talk. So thank you all. Sorry you could not get tickets. Yes, within the first 4 hours of putting our tickets out there, we had already booked out all seats. So immediately, and that's not because of Jabber Talk, let's face it. So Lenny Henry's in the room. Give me a break. Normally I'm like, can anyone like my post, please? And then 4 hours, tickets gone. So we had to move to the beautiful venue here, the Arboretum, and to welcome the Arboretum.
Arboretum.
There you go. You've heard it from Lenny Henry himself. He says it. He says everything way better than me. What can I say? So, but to welcome us, we have one of the directors, Ronald, in the house. Let's give him a cheer, everybody.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you, Pixie. Obviously, I'm not entertaining, so I can't follow that up. So my job is just to tell you who we are, what we're doing, and why you're in this beautiful space that you're in today. So I founded Library, which is literally next door. So it's been around for 7 years. It's a private members club. The whole emphasis is literature. So we have a lot of people that work in literature and thespians as well. So obviously, book launches are one of our favorite things to do. Having Sir Lenny Henry today is an absolute privilege, so I'm really delighted for that to happen. And Arboretum, which is a space that you're in today, opened earlier on this year, so we've been around for the last 7-8 months. My business partner is actually standing right at the back over there holding his phone up. He's now put it down because I'm pointing it out. But he runs the rest of this building, so there's 5 floors upstairs with lots of tenants and offices, etc. This is a private space where people can come in and have meetings, have presentations and talks like this, and just get to network. So Arboretum means botanical garden, for those that don't know. hence all the greenery around, this is all live, this is all... So the air quality in this room is exceptionally better than if you're standing outside on the street. And that is very, very intentional as well. Arboretum is, basically it's a membership. So if it's something you're interested in, you can apply and become a member. We're very, inclusive. I was going to say non-selective, but inclusive is much better. We're very, very inclusive, which...
Be a part-time door, like piece.
We're working on that. We're working on that. We're working on that. We can work... Yeah, definitely. But so to celebrate having Library, having Arboretum, we're going to give Sir Lenny a lifetime membership for obviously all the things.
Yeah, but you don't know how long I'm going to live.
That's the beauty of it.
I could get bonks known by a boss outside. You've only paid me for 5 minutes of lifetime, and that would be it. Thank you very much. I'm very grateful to this for the Arboretum. Thank you. And I will come here. Thank you very, very much. Cheers.
Right. I am going to hand over back to Jackie so she can do your proper introduction.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you very much. Thanks for coming.
And you know, Sir Lenny, you do know you can bring 3 guests with you. So you've got... Every time you come, we have a new friend. Okay. Yeah, we always need a pixie in the room. So right now we're not going to waste any more time because I know we've all come here to just celebrate a moment. It's like the very fact of how quickly you all bought your tickets to come tonight. And we know that this is not just about a book launch, but this is about celebrating the life of someone who we all love, who we all appreciate, who took us through so many journeys in our life, and you did it with so much grace and so much integrity. You never lost it, and we're so proud of you. So let's welcome again Sir Lenny Henry.
Thank you. It's very kind of you. What a lovely introduction. I'm literally blushing here. That's such a lovely introduction, and so nice for you to say that.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and absolutely true. So we are going to go through the book a little bit because there is so much. So for everyone to understand, who am I again? Lenny Henry's story. Now, this is only the very first start. It starts from birth up until when he was in Tiswas. So around the 1970s, may touch very slightly in the early 80s. But that's it. So we've only got this right up until he's in the 20s. There's still, another 3?
Enough book are coming
enough
up.
Enough book,
plenty,
right?
More.
So you want
plenty,
to get it
plenty
the
more book I come. I have to sit on and start now.
But so I've got to ask this because my biggest question was that they just did a movie, a program about you. You can see all my notes now. They did a program, a movie about you, and the name Danny and the
Human Zoo.
Thank you, Danny and the Human Zoo. And at the end of that, in this book, it actually says, at the end of that, you actually said, I don't know if I could ever, how I will ever get over that. The press reaction to it afterwards.
Yeah.
The how exposed you and your family, your friends, suddenly became. Because then suddenly it's not just about you, but then the press want to know about your family. So now suddenly they're calling everybody who knows you to find out more, to dig deeper.
Yeah.
And so you were saying, oh, well, that was such an intimate moment. I had to share it. I don't know if I could do that again. And so what you've done is you've given us even more.
Do it again.
Yeah, right?
Because I'm an idiot, my family says. you see, you was an idiot, you know. The film was bad enough, but now you write a book.
Right.
With more business. You're chatting our business out in public. You write another book. So the film was a major thing. It took 4 years to do it. And at first... it was a 4-part series.
That's right.
And it was about a musician called Danny, who was very talented, and his friends, and it was about his family. And it was going to be set in Dudley, but it wasn't going to be about me, but there were going to be bits of my life in it. And then everybody said, why isn't he a comedy impressionist? Why isn't it you? Yes. Why isn't he on New Faces? Why have you made it apart from you? And what I was trying to do was do a ting, right? I was trying to tell my story, but I wasn't trying to tell... my story, because it's I've spent so many years lying about my family that I wanted to do something that was closer to the truth. So we did Danny in the Human Zoo, and the producer, Nicola Schindler, said, I really like the writing, but I think you should write about yourself.
Yeah.
And you should try and get it as close to you as possible. You can still be in an alternate universe, so he can still be Danny Fearon, not Lenny Henry, and it can still be alluding to things that happened to you in your life, like winning new faces and your relationship with your mom and your relationship with your birth father. But it should be about a young kid who's funny and wants to be an impressionist. And I had to really bite my tongue because I knew my family would go, hmm. And then we did it, and I sent the script to everybody.
Yes.
And one and two said things and had things to say. One and two didn't reply at all.
Wow.
Because
wow.
Them can't read script.
What is, why you write it like this? What all this description doing here? So some of them didn't respond in the way I thought they were going to. And I'll tell you what my big sister Kay said is, you should tell the truth. You should just get it all out there. Rip it off like a plaster and just get it all out there. And I didn't want to do that. I thought, no, I've got to protect some of our privacy.
Right.
I think I'm saying enough. So it came out, and then the press just showed up, jumping out of a bush outside my sister's house and going to where my sister works and trying to ask questions. And my brother lives in Ireland, showing up in Ireland, and they wanted to know about my biological father. And as you know, this is an immigrant story, you know. It's not like a new thing. You know, my mum leaves Jamaica, where it was hard living in a patriarchal society, picking fruit and vegetables and going to market and selling what everybody else was selling. How much for your mango? Well, mine is cheaper than yours. You know, everybody was selling the same things. And it was just, she just knew there was a better life in Britain. And because Uncle Clifton had been here first, and he wrote her a letter, and he said, you must come here, you can get 30 shillings a week. P.S. Bring me a wife. And she did. She brought him somebody from church who knew Clifton and wanted to be married and wanted to get out of Jamaica. And so Madge came to Britain with Mom on the boat, and she did. She came here and she met Clifton, and thank God they liked each other, because that would have been a long walk back. Thank you for the meal. You is a gentleman, but you have to go back to home now. You can walk me halfway. But my mum was very, she loved being here. She loved the freedom of being in Britain. Mm. And she liked the idea of being independent. And I think after a while, she moved into a bedsit and she got very sick. She got pneumonia. And there was a very decent guy living in the same place called Albert Green, Bertie. And he was very kind and she never forgot it. And he made a Saturday soup where you have to boil the mutton for 5 hour. And you put in the hard food later. He did all that. He was a good cook. And he looked after her. And then when she was better, he showed her around Dudley and showed her around where the work was. Because you had to know people in them days, you know, because it was no blacks, no Irish, no dogs, like they say. And he basically showed her where they were hiring. And my mum became this person. She became this person she was one of the first to arrive in Dudley post-Windrush. And she just said, I'm going to help people that were like me. So she became this person that you went to. Mrs. Henry, where does any work? And she would help people find work, and she can make dresses. She had 3 jobs.
Right.
Cook, she made dresses, and she worked in a factory. And people would come to her and all that kind of stuff. And she had this relationship with this guy called Albert, and he was a really nice guy. She liked him a lot. But my dad wasn't here. So they were having this relationship. Mm. And then she wrote, when she fell pregnant, she wrote to my dad and said, there's been a mistake, and I understand it if you don't want to be with me, but if you still think we can make it work, I will do what I can and whatever, and if you can forgive me, let's try. And when my dad arrived, he said he forgave her, but he hadn't really forgiven her. Mm. So I remember growing up in a house that was full of tensions. And when you're a comedian, that comes out different to if you're a playwright or something. Mm-hmm. When you're a comedian, you make up stuff about your mum. So my mum hit me a lot when I was a kid. But we're a third world people and we just talk about beating and it's funny. But I had black journalists saying, you mustn't do that because you're perpetuating a stereotype. And I said, it's true, but it was still beatings.
Right. With a frying pan.
With a frying pan, with a stick, with a broom, with a tree.
Right.
My mum once threw a table at me. I ran up the stairs and ran the corner and the chair followed me round the corner. And blaps!
Wow.
So my mum was serious, and she was a big lady. She was a big woman, and she had big, hard-working farm fists.
Right.
She had chicken-strangling fists. You know them women who can just strangle a chicken and start cooking it straight away and yank the guts? She was one of them women. So she didn't play.
And she fought back. She, no, so if they had arguments, which yes. I would see as a little child, I would see their arguments on a regular basis. She held her own. She was bigger than my dad.
She could.
Plap! They would fight, and I would see it. So I grew up in that house, and so there were tensions there.
Right, but because in the book you refer to the fact that a lot of these tensions you knew were sometimes about you, but of course you didn't know.
I had no idea. I had no
you
idea.
Thought Winston was your father. You thought you were just...
Yeah, yeah. He raised me. He was there all the time. He was steady. He was reliable.
Right.
He was with my mum all the time. He brought his wages home. He gave it to her. You know that thing with Caribbean working class people, you know, you give them money, the pay packets mm-hmm. at the end of the week.
Exactly.
And she takes out the rent and the shoes and the food and everything, and she gives him a pound back. What am I going to do with this woman? And the first time I took a show business pay pack home, I gave it to my mom. She moved my dad from the head of the table and put me and put me in his place. Give me the big piece of meat. 9 dumpling. I was like, this is great. I'm going to do this next week. When I bought her a house, everything changed.
Right.
It was great. So it was really weird growing up in the house. There were atmospheres, there were tensions all the time. Because my mom, once I was born and once Winston showed that he was angry, she went back to Bertie and they had 2 more kids. So
right.
So the ones that were born in Dudley were fathered by Bertie. But the dad that raised us, Winston raised us till the day he died.
Yes.
So that's weird, right? But that's not an uncommon story. When I was doing Dan in the Human Zoo, the director, Destiny Ekaraga, who's brilliant, hi, Destiny, she said to us all, and a lot of black people in the room, she said, who of us here has other family? Who of us here has another biological, and everybody went, hands went up. Everybody talked about it, and it wasn't an unusual thing. So to me, this is a diaspora story. This is what happens when you're immigrants and you move from one country to the next. You know, you,
it's all
can't,
part of the survival.
You can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs. And if you've been in a patriarchal relationship that's been tough on you, when you move to a next country, what happens is people feel like they've got freedom.
Right.
And my mom felt a little bit of freedom when she came here.
Right.
And was happy for a while.
So if we, because we're on this line then, so then if we jump forward to then when you do actually find out that Uncle Bertie...
Is not my uncle.
Is not your uncle.
Is my birth father, yeah.
Is your birth father. Because I'm not giving everything away because I want you to buy the book because it's absolutely brilliant.
Everything is in the book, you know.
Everything's in the book. It's all there in the book. But it's like you were going there, you were, you know, cleaning his apartment.
No, it was a thing of Len... I want you to go downtown and see Bertie. He's your uncle. And I want you to know him. Go down there on a Friday after school and help him. And you never know, he might get a little pocket money. That was the deal.
Was
and I was
it.
Like, huh? Pocket money? I was like, extra pocket money? That could be all right. Right. So I started to go down on a Friday after school.
Yes.
And it wasn't until he had a grown-up son called Lloyd. And Lloyd used to watch me doing the hoovering and sweeping out the room and washing the dishes. And Lloyd, he just looked at me, you're an idiot, you know.
But said, this is 18 months of watching you do
yeah,
this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like a couple of weeks.
But he would show up every so often, Lloyd, and watch me, and we'd eat together and everything. And I became part of that group, the 3 men in that room. I was only 12 or something. And Lloyd said, he's your dad. And it really rocked my world. I was like, oh, my God. That guy is my birth father. And so I went in the kitchen and he was making the rice and he was banging it against the wall to see if it was done, you know, that thing.
Yeah.
And he was cooked down chicken. It was smelt nice, but my brain was frazzled. I said, Lloyd says you're my dad, is it true? And he just went, yes, your mama never tell you.
Right.
And I'm like 61 now, and I'm telling you, he could have handled that a lot better than that. But that's how people were, you know. And it wasn't just me one, it was lots of us. So, I mean, I'm not. You know, what's great is to write the book and to have that story out there, people keep saying, oh, you're very brave. My friend Neil, oh, you're very brave. It wasn't brave. It's the story, and I'm glad it's there.
It's beautiful, and you're very courageous
Bev,
with it.
My elder sister Bev was very didn't want me to didn't want me to have the story out there. She wanted, because Mum died in 1998, she wanted Mum to be able to rest in peace. But I said, this is, it's my story as well.
Exactly.
And I've got to be able to tell my story. I'm a creative. I want to be able to tell my story. And this is, you know, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. If you don't write about things that upset you, that move you, then you're not going to move anybody else.
Right, exactly. Because that was part of the story that did bring me to tears. Because you, I mean, like how we, he was just explaining, you know, his mum chasing him around and throwing the table at him and we all laughed. And then when you start back, that's what I kept doing in the book. I'd laugh because it's beautifully written. But then you'd say, wait, she threw a table at his head. And this is a young boy of 5 years old.
But actually you would,
but you haven't written it in a way where you're trying to get any kind of pity or sympathy. You're literally just sharing, this is the journey that I went on then.
But I had a black journalist say, I've told you, you shouldn't keep doing that about your mum beating you. It makes us look bad. It's a third world stereotype and all that kind of stuff. And that is all true. But I grew up in a house full of beatings and clartings and bitch licks. And I reserve the right to tell my story.
Absolutely. And out of that came your superpower. Because that's when you realise the power of making someone laugh.
Yeah. And, you know, my mum had a very good laugh. And I'd watch her, you sit watching her watch television. And it was things like all the things we watched, Frank Spencer, Eric and Ernie, Two Ronnies. And my mum, when something really sweet at her, Jesus Christ, boy! Lord God, am I going to kill me? She was like that. And I just thought, I would watch her laughing and think, wouldn't it be great to be able to get a reaction like that from somebody? And she was a great storyteller. Well, let me tell you something. She was a great storyteller. And she peopled her stories with characters and descriptions and funny mispronunciations. And she was naturally funny, my mom. So I would watch this. And my dad, because Winston, you know, was in a house where these kids, the three of the kids weren't his, he rarely said anything. But Mum did enough for everybody. Mum right. was the one. Mum was funny. Mum was the alpha in our family. And she was so entertaining. When she wanted to be, when she was in a mood, she could flip and she would box you. And this is when everybody got boxed. It wasn't just me. The teachers would box you at school. I don't know if you remember that. Yeah. When I went to school in the 70s, the teacher would lean over and backhand you across the face. And then, except this one time, Mr. Edmonds in art, I was about 9, we were doing art, and I, for some reason, I flicked some paint at this kid. Mr. Edmonds saw it, and he kicked me up the bum. And I knew, I was only 8 or 9, but I knew that was wrong.
Right, thank
God. And then I went home, and I said, Mr. Edmonds kicked me. and Mum went, all right. And she didn't go to work in the morning. I thought, because work is important, right? Mum goes to work. She wasn't going to work. She took me to school and you could hear her. And she let me go in. I went into his class and I sat there and you could hear, where is Mr. Headmans? And, oh, gosh, you know, who tell him he could beat my child? Like, I'm the one who beats my child, not him. Tell him to come out here now. And it was like really, and everybody on all the kids were like, what the hell's going to happen now? And Mr. Edmonds, you hit my child again. You put your foot on my child. My child, your foot. You put your foot bottom upon my child. Wow. And it went on. And the head teacher came out. Mrs. Henry, don't you, Mrs. Henry, me. And it was a major league Armageddon style telling off. I mean, I don't know how she didn't hit the guy. And Mr. Edmonds was really, he never came near me for weeks. He barely taught me, this guy. He was really frightened of me. He wouldn't come near me. And then what happened was this. We went to Dudley Baths and we all go on the coach. And Dudley Baths is hardcore, you know, there's shopping trolleys in it and dead puppies and everything. You got to swim round them. But that's where we did our red. Do you remember red and we did the green? And I can't swim. I know people think black, but you know, we come from a highland, we don't need to swim. But I can't swim at all. And I dove in to do my red.
Oh, no.
And you had to swim a width. And I suddenly felt myself underwater, looking up, going, what? Why am I underwater? Why can't I move? And I was trying to
this
move,
is terrible.
But I wasn't. I was drowning, and I started to inhale water. hears this, right? Boom! The water goes like that beside me, and Mr. Edmonds is underwater.
Oh.
And he grabs me, and he life saves me to the side.
Oh.
And he opens my mouth, and I'm awake, but he's looking at me. And he breathes, and I cough up water, cough up water, cough up water. And then I went home to Mum, and I was wet. What happened to you? I fell in the pool, and I was drowning, and Mr. Edmonds saved me. Mr. Edmonds' life saved me, and he gave me the kiss of life. And, he, and Mum went to school the next, where is that Mr. Edmonds? I want to shake his hand. He saved my boy's life, and I want to burn. And he hid in a cupboard. And he waited till she left. But that's true. And she was fearsome. And she protected her family.
Yes.
So what she did to us was one thing, but if anybody else did it, she was a lioness, and she didn't take any mess. So, you know, okay, yes, we got beat, but we knew that she had our backs when anybody else had a go at us.
Right.
It was interesting. I remember this one kid. People were frightened of her, so I got chased all the way up the park by this one kid, and I got to my gate, and Mama opened the door, and this kid just, he turned into this, like, child. But when he was on the park, he was like, ah! And he was calling me all these names, but when he got to the door and he saw my mum, he went, and he just disappeared. So Mum was fearsome, and people knew her around town. They knew that Winnie, Big Winnie, was not to be messed with.
Right,
so we had that. And my big sister Kay was the same. Kay was tough. And
brilliant.
I couldn't, because interestingly, you know, when you watch an American movie, come on, son, let's put the boxing gloves on and I'll teach you how to fight. Let's throw a ball around. I didn't have any of that with my dad. Was very, both of them were very hands off. So I never learned how to fight until much later. So my sister Kay would come to, because Kay was born in Jamaica. The Jamaican ones were different to us.
Right.
We were born in, the Jamaican ones would pick up a rock stone and hit somebody. And we go, no, we don't do that here. We don't pick up a rock stone and hit people in this country. We fight with our fists. What do you mean, fists? No, we fight with our fists. Ephraim, right, this kid called Ephraim, dressed like his dad, hat on the back of his head, leather waistcoat, big trousers, big old boots. This kid called him a name, and Ephraim boxed him down, boxed him 9 times, then picked up a house brick to finish the job. And
we went, no,
we don't do that here. So, you know, the Jamaicans were different to us, and Kay was Jamaican.
Yeah.
So if Kay saw somebody picking on me, she would steam in and just box them down.
Exactly. No,
so it was
brilliant.
Great.
And what I've noticed then...
I'm a superhero for a sister.
Yeah, no, really, right? Mm-hmm. You really did. And so we'll go back to, you know, your pathway into comedy and then how it went from there. But one of the themes, of course, in this book, because you were so young, is your family. And you're so protective of your family. And I noticed that, you know, you say really strong things, very quick and passing as though it's nothing. But you're like, you know, I was so pleased as soon as the money started to come in, that I was able to then provide for my family.
Help.
And I was able to help them. And
that's
Yeah, you buy them carpets. And, you know, you became the main breadwinner.
Yeah, because Mum was doing
it all. But you were 20 years old. I need to put that in because we need to keep it in context. You were a young man. So you'd gone from a young boy to finding your way through a very hostile, both in the family, how it was just, you know, a lot of aggression in that hostile environment, but then also at school where you were bullied a lot. And now you've now become a young man, and most young men in those situations would fly away and escape. But you have this strong sense of family that did not move. And I think that was quite amazing.
Yeah,
there's not a question there. I'm just saying things now.
But you could feel the sense of when one of us makes it, we all make it.
Yes.
And I think a lot of Caribbean families and third world families go, well, you know, that one's going to help everybody else.
Mm.
And so it was a thing of people would come and ask for things, and I would try and help whenever I could, because Mum used to do that. I noticed when Mum won at the bingo, everybody had won. Because
brilliant.
She'd get to the, by the time she got to the door, half the money had gone. Mrs. Henry, you can lend me £1, £10. I want to buy a shirt for, you know, and it was always, I want to buy a piece of carpet, or I want to pay off the grocery bill, or I want to get some trousers for... And she was very generous when Mum won at the bingo. But now, here's me, and I'm in show business, and I do 2 years on the Fosters, and suddenly, my sister Sharon said the other day, everybody's shoulders went down, because I could help. I could help to buy a fridge, or a television, or a piece of carpet. And it wasn't... I was a bit... I felt a bit weird about it, because I was the young... I was kind of the fifth one. But actually, I had to grow up fast, because people were depending on me. So it was a thing of, you know, look, you're the main breadwinner, and we expect you to behave in a certain way, and if we want... And we're going to ask you for help sometimes. And sometimes it was all right. Sometimes it was difficult. Seymour always asked for very specific amounts of money. Lynn, I want to borrow £675. 32 pence. And I need it in £5 increments in envelopes. Posted all over the town on odd days. You know, Seymour always had very specific things. But the rest of them were very respectful. And it was... It felt good to help, actually. Yeah. It felt good to help my mum. And when she was sick, the last 7 years of her life was very tough for us. And I was able to contribute to the care. I was able to pay for the care. And it, we needed it. She was, you know, she was a double amputee, right? You know, it was tough. So it was really, you know, diabetes in our community, tough. And she was a double amputee, and she had heart condition, and she needed all the help she could get, 24 hours a day. So I was able to do that. And when you're the one that can do that, it's not even a question. You just do it. So that was what the feeling was there.
Right. So, okay, so then going back to you finding your superpower as a comedian. Tell us a little bit about that journey, because it was like you realised, oh, wait a minute, I can make my mum laugh. And when I make my mum laugh... then she's happier. And when she's happier, we're all happier. But then you then turned it on your friends. Ah, he keeps bullying me. I mean, like, there was this one particular guy who kept constantly beating him up practically every day after school. Yeah. So, you know, it's easy for us to sit here and look at Sir Lenny Henry and see his path. But you've got to imagine this was the young boy who didn't know at that point you had this future.
But remember, we're in an area where... We live in Dudley. Wolverhampton's over there where the Rivers of Blood speech was first given by Enoch Powell. Smethwick is where that guy got in to the Tory party with the slogan, if you want an N-word for a neighbour, vote Labour. You know, keep Britain white was on the walls. When Seymour and Hilton first arrived in Dudley, they were regularly attacked by Teddy Boys. And they were Jamaican boys, so the Teddy Boys came off the worst. But they regularly attacked... My mum was racially abused every day when she was walking down the street. People asking, making monkey noises. I mean, you know, we're in the 21st century. That's still happening. When is that going to stop? So our family had to put up with a lot. So for me, going to school and having this stuff, this was like normal. You know, I went to a school called Jessens where me, Michael Coleman, and this other girl were the only black people in the year. And Michael Coleman used to beat me up for company. We'd fight for company because nobody else would talk to us. And then when I went to Blue Coat, there were more black kids there, more black and Asian kids. Because remember, the Ugandan Asians came over in mid to sort of late, like 73, 74. So there were suddenly more Asians in the school. So there was a lot of racism going around. And it was, you know, kids would spit in your face. People would beat you up or trip you up. Or there was one kid who was a boxer. And it was very tough. He used to use me as a punch bag because he said I was big and I could take it. You know, this was weird. So I got into this thing of this one day where I just thought something needs to happen here because I can't be a punch bag for people anymore. And this one guy would call me the names that I got called every day. Nig Nog, Coon, Wog. I made a documentary and called Race Through Comedy. It was on Gold. It's still there. And the woman from Famalam, who's a young woman, she's only 19, 20, 21, and very attractive young woman, was watching a clip from Alf Garnett and from Love Thy Neighbour. And do you know what she said? She said, "What's Sambo? what, Sambo? She'd never heard the word Sambo. And I was like, yes!
Yes!
You've never been called Sambo. That's genius. That's something to celebrate.
Right?
That's one thing that nobody gets called anymore.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my God, that's fantastic. She doesn't know. She knew the other
progress.
Ones. But a little bit of progress. Anyway, so when you get called these things over the time, it beats you down. And this one day, this kid said, you know, Nig Nog Coon, and he knocked me to the floor. And I just said, you must really fancy me because you keep wanting to knock me to the ground and roll around on the floor with me. And he looked at me weird, and then people started to gather and go, and they didn't say fight, 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 like they normally did, but they were standing there waiting for me to say the next thing.
Right.
And I said something like, "I, you hit me, I hit you, you call me names, why don't we just go for a dinner and a movie and make the best of it or something? And they started to laugh, and eventually they were laughing at the things I was saying, and he still, listen, this isn't a John Hughes movie. The guy still picked on me for the next few weeks. But after a while, it started to diminish because suddenly there were all these kids who were on my side.
Right.
And there's a thing called, you know, there's an in-group and there's an out-group. And suddenly I was in the in-group because they were the ones who were on Lenny Henry's side against this kid. And eventually he had to back off because he was in a minority and he didn't like it.
Wow. You must have felt so powerful. Probably the most powerful at that point for the first time in your life, right?
Yeah.
That you had some control.
Yeah, it was amazing. It still happened outside, you know. There were still skinheads who stopped you and wanted to beat you up and whatever. I mean, that doesn't happen so much. Although in the lead up to Brexit and UKIP and everything, I've noticed people are more likely to come out with things, say offensive things in your earshot. I was in a superstore a couple of months ago, and a guy just walked past this lady, this black lady, and just bounced against her. And she was very calm, and she said, in my earshot, you see that? That's happening more and more now. People aren't scared to show what they feel and what they think.
What they really think.
Yeah, and that's, it's why people are saying to millennials, you guys got to vote, because I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them, you know, the kids got to vote.
Right.
Because otherwise there's going to be no change. And at the moment we're being embarrassed by a 16-year-old Swedish girl.
I know, right?
And we got to get on board, otherwise things are going to be topsy-turvy for a while.
I know. It's an interesting time to live in.
To answer your question, bullying continued. There were still other people doing it, but that one kid backed off. Because suddenly I had a little gang around me.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it was good. It was a good feeling.
Exactly. And so then you went through school. So then tell us about, it was New Faces first.
Yes. New Faces, Like Their Voice, or Britain's Got Talent, or something nowadays.
When did you first realise that you could even do impressions?
Well, don't you think Caribbean people, third world people, immigrants can mimic anybody anyway? How do you think we fit in? How do you think we assimilate? You go to any Asian restaurant anywhere in this country, in Britain, and people have taken on, all right, pal, you know, people have taken on the local accent so they can communicate,
right?
And they can I saw my mum doing it, I saw my uncles doing it. You become, if you live in Dudley, everybody talks like this, so you see these black people talking like this as well.
Right.
How much for that sweet potato? Have you got any dasheen left? I want some chow chow. And because you've got to communicate, because if you talk to them in patois, they don't quite get it.
Exactly. Yeah, no.
Could you slow down? I don't understand what you're saying. I always like it when a Jamaican character appears in a film and they subtitle it. What am I subtitling for? Because people are so speaky-spoky. Hi, I'm speaking very good English. Why do you have to subtitle me? Hi, I'm speaking the Queen's English correctly. And so they don't have to subtitle us. But they always do, and I like that. That makes me laugh. But, you know, we assimilate. And my mum told us to integrate.
Yes.
Rivers of blood, rivers of blood, keep Britain where. You must integrate, you know. Then we're prison, we all. Integrate, try not to box them down. Mingle with the people, them. Heat their nasty food. Integrate. You must integrate, you understand? No. Integrate. She went on and on at us, and she was trying to protect us.
Right, exactly.
Because we were Jamaican at the house. We ate Jamaican food. We didn't mix with anybody. We were just Jamaican. My mama, we want cornflakes. what Sydney Cornflakes, they're not. we spoke Jamaican, we ate Jamaican, we lived in a Jamaican house.
Right.
And then there was this moment when she said, you guys better fix up and start mixing with people. Otherwise, they'll keep picking on you.
Exactly. And you're just not going to get anywhere.
So that's when I noticed that actually everything I've been watching on television, Dave Allen, Frank Spencer, Eric and Ernie, Two Ronnies, the comedians, Who Do You Do, I could do those voices. It came naturally to me. I wasn't even the funniest one in our family, but it came naturally to me.
Right.
And I just thought, that's something that makes them laugh. And when I went outside with the guys, I had three white friends called Mac, Greg and Tom, and they would tell me when I was being funny, that's funny. They'd say, that's really funny.
So then you can't kind of repeat
when,
that.
Yeah, when you do Scooby-Doo, that's really funny, that is. And I go, huh? And they go, what do you mean, that's funny? They go, no, that's funny. And Deputy Dog, I'm Musky, you know, all that stuff. Mm. And the hooky friend, they liked those voices. Mm. And they liked the Jamaican stuff too, but they mainly liked all the cartoons and any impressions that I did off the telly. They thought that was funny. And they thought it was funny because it was a black guy doing it.
Exactly.
And I didn't think anything of that because I always thought of myself as I'm a Dudley kid and I'm from Dudley. But when I saw the New Faces footage recently, I went, oh, my God. My back was to the audience. I'm doing Frank Spencer. And then I turn round and there's a palpable paradigm shift in the audience. You can hear people going,
exactly right.
Oh my God, he's black. They were not expecting that. And because of that one thing, that one moment, I didn't stop work for 10 years.
Wow.
People would ring up and go, can the black kid who was on New Faces come to my working men's club, please? I never stopped work. And it just went on and on and on.
And it just grew from
there. I wasn't even any good. I had the 3 minutes that I didn't have any material. I just had the 3 minutes that I did on television. And they go, don't you know anymore? No. All right, then. Here's half the money. No. I had to figure out how to get all the money. I needed all the money because my family, you come back with 3/4 of the money. Mm. I had to learn how to do an hour. And that took like 10 years. To do a proper hour, that took 10 years. Oh, it was terrible. And yeah, I had to really learn.
Wait, you were terrible. How old were you at the time?
16.
Come on.
So, 16, 17, 18, 19,
and this
20.
This is back in like the 70s, 80s.
Where they killed you if you weren't funny. Them clubs were tough, man.
No, they were tough. But we weren't into like, children were allowed to be children then. So a 16 back in the 70s was much younger than a 16-year-old now.
Oh, yeah. I was a child.
You were a child.
And in many respects, there are many things that happened to me, like being in a minstrel show, like having people say offensive things to my face, where I wished my brother Seymour had come to my rescue, real talk about, you know, and just on my behalf. And my family did this thing where they said, oh, other people are in charge of this now. This is what Len wants to do. We're not going to interfere with what Len's doing. It clearly works. And they just basically said,
there you go.
They gave me to these other people.
Yeah, because it's not like now that you'd have to have a guardian. Now somebody would have to travel with you to be, you know, like your parents.
Yeah,
somebody would have been there. Back then, there was none of that.
But I didn't know what it meant. And I remember watching an interview with Eddie Murphy. And he said he was tired of people talking about his entourage because it was his stepdad, his brother, and his best friend. It wasn't an entourage. And what they were doing was looking after him. So,
right.
A, they were being security, but also they were watching what he was doing and helping him to be as funny as he could be.
Right.
As funny as they knew Eddie could be in the circumstances. They'd be on a film set with him, and they'd tell him when he was being really funny. And you need that. You need somebody on your side doing that for you.
But you didn't really have...
I didn't have anybody doing that for me.
No.
And all the key decisions in my life in the first 10 years were made by me basically saying yes to everything and my manager who was just there because, I mean, he was a decent guy, but he was basically there because I was this kid who was going to make him some money.
Right.
And he was all right. But he didn't have my back like a family member would have.
Exactly.
I didn't have a lawyer.
Left out there.
If anybody's listening to this, don't sign anything. Don't sign whatever anybody says. If you don't know a lawyer, find one. Look in the paper. Google it. But get a lawyer to look over the paperwork, because that will bite you on the backside.
Right. Then you're suddenly
when you question
trapped.
It in 3 years' time, you're trapped because you've signed papers. And my mum, God bless her soul, she was a working woman. She was, you know, she worked on a farm in Jamaica. She was a factory lady. She didn't know anything about contracts. She co-signed. Mm. She co-signed a very binding contract, which I couldn't get out of for 10 years. Mm. So, I had beef with people for years. So I went through a period where I was really sad. Mm. You know, I was in a minstrel show for 5 years. Nobody would come and see me. I'd be the only black person in a 200-mile radius.
Right.
I think my mom came, but she wore a paper bag on her head one time.
Right. So they'd have things to say about you, but nobody was really stepping up and saying, wait a minute, he's one of ours, he's a young man.
No, nobody did that.
We're going to protect him. You were there alone.
My sister Sharon was, when she was younger than me, and Sharon was very critical. Sharon and Paul were very critical of everything I did. She couldn't understand what I was doing in that show. Mm. And everybody breathed a sigh of relief when I wasn't in that show anymore. And I had to kind of almost go around everybody's house in the world and apologize to them and then move on with my career.
Right.
From the minute I was in the Cannon and Ball show in Blackpool, everything changed, because suddenly black people wanted to come and see me and they weren't embarrassed to be in the audience.
Right.
And then when I was in Three of a Kind, suddenly I was doing Theophilus P. Wildebeest and I'd get chased around the room by middle-aged black women. Come here, Lenny, you cutie! I had that. So suddenly things changed. And when I made Live and Unleashed, that was amazing. Mm. Because Live and Unleashed was a watershed for me, 1988 or whenever it was. Suddenly there were more black people in the audience looking and joining in with the show and enjoying it and talking to me and wanting to be part of the experience. And that, for me, that was a big breakthrough.
Right.
It was almost like they'd gone, well, yeah, move on from the minstrel stuff now and just come with Delbert. They wanted to see what everybody else was seeing.
Right.
Because I was, you know, I had my own show and they were aware that I was the kid who had his own show on television now.
Right. And so, did you hear me? We've called this book. So, you've called this book, Who Am I Again? Throughout the book, you mention about the fact, you got to get it. There were so many photographs, and then I love it because in each photograph, you start explaining, now this is me. But what I love is you say, now I'm looking like that. Now I'm looking worried because, and I've got that face on because. And it's almost like you are describing the mask or the persona of the person that you had to become at that point in order to survive the journey you were on, right?
Once again, I think this is they call it code switching now, the millennials. Mm. It's to be in a certain situation, you switch yourself up.
Yeah.
When you're with the lads, you have banter. When you're with your family, you have something else. When you're with your brothers and sisters, you have something else. When you're at work, you have something else. People adopt different masks at different times so they can be part of the furniture.
Yeah.
And I was doing that everywhere I went. I was wearing a different mask at different points. And everything I did, I was being thrown into the deep end because I was inexperienced and I didn't know what the hell to do.
And remember, you had one to follow here, really. There was a few people
but
from
the
black community.
Williams. We had Charlie Williams.
But there was a
we had
big
Josh
gap
White.
Between you.
We had some. Well, yeah, Charlie Williams was big people.
Mm.
And he'd played football for Doncaster Rovers. Mm. And he'd been a coal miner. We're all the same colour down the pit. He had jokes like that. And then... you know, you better laugh or I'll come and move in next door to you. It was all that. And he was really Yorkshire. He was really Yorkshire. And they loved him for that. But he was very much a unicorn. He was the black Yorkshireman who made everybody laugh. And Charlie knew what he was doing. He had that thing of, I'm going to say all these jokes that you would tell about me if you're with your friends. I'm going to do them first.
Mm.
And then he would talk about growing up in Doncaster as a young black kid. Then he would talk about working in the pit and being a miner and being a footballer. And he would tell stories that weren't inflected by race. But when I was not doing very well in the clubs, all the club owners would say, you need to be more like Charlie Williams. You need to tell jokes about being black. And you need to make fun of yourself. Because otherwise, what's the point of you? And so I did that for a while. And it was horrible.
Yes, right.
Tell jokes about myself. And I hated it. And then when alternative comedy came along in 1978, 79, 80, I went to the Comedy Store and I saw people like Rick Mayall and Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders and Alexis Sale telling jokes that were not racist or sexist, but they were passionate and they were political and they had a point of view and they were fearless and they were just doing jokes about being middle class or about being left-wing or about what was going on in the papers or about what it was like to be 17 or 18. They were just doing jokes about human stuff. Mm. Nobody was the butt of the joke. It was right. All about the jokes were turned inward in a self-deprecatory way, or it was about being middle class, or about being left-wing, or about being a lesbian, or about being a feminist. Mm. They weren't, do you know what I mean? They weren't telling offensive jokes about anybody else. And I went, I think I could do that. Right. I think I could talk about my family. I think I could do characters from my social group. I think I could still do the impressions, but I think I could do humour that was more uplifting than against myself. Because every time you do a joke against yourself, you're doing jokes against everybody in your social group.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that anymore.
Brilliant.
It took a while to do because I had to learn. So I remember Christopher Asante, who was Matthew in Desmond's. Lenny, I want to talk to you about Katanga, my friends. And for about an hour, he had me in reception at London Weekend Television telling me why I shouldn't do that character. And I was really kind of, I still did it, but I was really, paid for my mom's house. But I understood what he was saying. And I just thought, okay, well, if you're going to do, you need to be more accurate when you do characters. They need to be based in truth, not in silliness. People don't appreciate it. People don't appreciate if you represent them wrongly. Mm. And what was great was Delbert, for instance, was based on someone. And it came out of when we were watching the Brixton riots on television. Paul Boateng, who I know now, was on telly and he was so angry on the news. He was practically foaming at the mouth. And I went, we need somebody else to talk about the Brixton riots. Mm. We need a ute. We need a geezer like this. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, the geezer stopped me, man. The policeman stopped me. I was in my Vorsprung Dorch Wellard. Because utes had jokes about the police stopping them. You know, stop and search is one thing, but you never heard about the jokes. It was always, oh, stop and search is bad. And them punch him in him belly and it turn to jelly. Them lick him pan him back. It was always the tough side of that, the Linton Kwesi Johnson side of that. You never heard the jokes. And young black guys had loads of jokes. And I just thought, we need a guy like that on Panorama. Yeah, man, I was in my car, yeah, and the geezer pulled me over. He put his head through the window, which worried me because it wasn't wound down at the time. You know, people had a natural wit. And I wanted to see that on telly. You never saw that on telly. You still don't, actually. Mm. And I just thought, we need to see young black people represented on television in a more positive way where they have their own agency, you know.
So the whole
diversity campaigning stuff is just about representation. It's just about inclusivity and about giving people that look like us, that are like us, where whatever us means, a place at that table that we keep talking about,
right?
The decision making table. And if we're not at that table, then somebody is making decisions about us.
Exactly. And we have no say in it.
We have no say in it.
We have no power.
And, you know, it's still, you know, you go anywhere in the media and the people in charge still don't really look like me or you. Mm. And we need to, the reason why you have, I mean, Tyler Perry just kicks the door down now.
I know. Well.
Tyler Perry's just built his own studio and said, come and work with me. Yeah. And that's what we got to do. We got to stop. I think that we need access to funding. Mm. I'll leave a black people on the power list. They're not funding anything. We need to start knocking on doors and saying, you need to start funding this.
Give me some of your money.
Give me some of your money. I want to do a play. I want to be on telly.
Right.
We want to make Watchmen. We want to make Chernobyl.
Very true. No, very true.
You know, so they need to get involved in funding the arts because there's a cultural responsibility to tell a variety of stories, not just one type of story.
No, absolutely.
But I think only when the decision makers, the gatekeepers, the producers, the executives look like when you're walking down the street in your area, only when it looks like that are things going to change. And we're a long way away. And here's the thing. the in-group who are in charge of everything are getting a bit complacent and a bit laissez-faire about diversity. Haven't we had that conversation?
Oh,
haven't
yeah,
we,
yeah.
Haven't we There's had your story? Me. No! You don't know anything about me. You know, I want to tell my stories like this.
Exactly.
And then when you do tell your story, they say, you know, they mistake being pro-black for being anti-white. And just because something's pro-black, it doesn't mean it's anti-white.
Yeah, no, exactly.
It can just be a representation or a truthful representation of your story. Mm. And people have to learn to make the decision. And people also have to stop being upset when racism gets called out. Not everybody's racist, we know this. But when you hear monkey chants at a football match, somebody's doing it.
Exactly.
And somebody has to take responsibility for it.
It's that simple, right? We have to just start acknowledging that, okay, you may not mean to be racist, but what you just said right there, it's racist. So we've got to change society.
But it could be through ignorance. Exactly. It could be because you don't know any people that aren't like you.
Exactly.
Are you the only black people? Are you the only black person? Ever been the only black person that's been in somebody's house? You walk in and do you eat chicken? You're like, yeah, I eat the hell out of chicken. Where is it? You having a dumpling? You know, it's like, but it's like that. You know, I feel sometimes when you're at work, you can feel a bit like the black friend. You know, the black person who wasn't in Friends.
Right? Yeah.
You know, they're over there, down, diddly, down, 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 messing around on the couch with the light, and the black ones are like, when are we going to be able to play on the couch and in the fountain?
I know, hello, can we sit there too?
Mind you, we didn't want to go in the fountain because we'll mess up our weave, right? Can't go in the fountain, you're mad?
Weave?
I just had my hair did. But yeah, so, I mean, all of these things are, I love talking about it because inclusion is a big thing. And inclusivity is all of us. It's not just the black ones, it's the brown ones, it's the people with disabilities, it's the people, and mental, and disability isn't just physical, it could be mental, it could be, there's a plethora of things. And there's alternate sexualities, there's gender, there's a lot of things going on.
Yeah.
And as August Wilson says, you know, some of us can only wave our flag from where we stand. It's all right to say, I'm representing this. I'm gonna talk about from where I stand. Right. It's all right to talk about the black thing. It's all right to talk about the gay thing. If that's what you want to do. If you want to represent everybody, go ahead and do that. But some of us only want to talk about the lack of black people in media. And that's all right. You can't represent everybody. You can't speak for everybody. But it's tricky because sometimes the way the dominant culture operates is by lumping everything into one box. And saying, you guys in there, you want the same thing, we're going to put you all together. And then you're in this area of intersectionality where people are expecting, you know, Kimberly Shaw said, everybody's in a room on everybody's shoulders, and the person at the top goes up through the trap door, and there's an expectation that you're going to reach down and pull somebody up. And there's a problem if people don't reach down. Hooray, I'm through the trap door, and now I'm going to be a superstar. But people have to remember to reach down and pull the next person up.
Okay.
Otherwise, the person at the bottom of the ladder is never going to get up there.
That is so true and so wonderful. And the very fact that you are saying that when you were almost just kind of left alone to fend for yourself when you first started out, is that why you're so keen to help others coming up? Because you know that
If I find it tough, I've got a production company. And if I find it tough to operate...
So you still find it tough?
Yeah! So if you're a new person of colour or whatever in an industry and you've just started, I hear horror stories about how people are neglected or can't even get a foot in the door.
Mm.
It's difficult. So if I'm saying that, it's really difficult for people who are...
Who's got no... And
yeah, you need flavour and juice and, you know, Idris or Stormzy. You need to knock on the door with Stormzy there and Idris there. Going, yeah, what's up?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely
Let's
right.
Let's do this. It just does a lot of things.
Okay, you know what?
He just is in fashion. He's on magazine covers.
He's right.
He's going to be the black James Bond.
I know.
Can you imagine he's just driving down the street in that Austin Martin. How long would it be? Woo, 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 woo. Is this your car, sir? Q gave it to me. Who's Q? Sounds like a drug dealer. Get out the car.
That's
Black Bond my backside.
You don't think it will happen? Don't you remember?
Whatever, Black Bond. We need to make something up ourselves.
Oh, we should have our own.
Yeah,
what,
man.
What would that look like?
We need our own. We need to make up our own heroes. Because you know, Ian Fleming was in the 60s. Mm. Surely there's people that can make something that represents, you know, because there's black people in the Secret Service.
No, it's very true.
Why can't we create a new agent?
Wakanda forever.
Wakanda forever, my friends. People lost their minds when the Black Panther was on, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
I went to the BFI premiere. It was people in Kente, so much Kente cloth. People with jollof rice and chicken and peanut stew.
It's true.
Jamaicans with Saturday soup. Hey, well, Wakanda forever. Don't even know where. People buying tickets to Wakanda. Where is Wakanda? I want to go. Anything is better than living in Lewisham. I want to.
Oh,
people wanting to go to Wakanda. It was brilliant. They better bring out a second movie soon.
Oh, yeah, no.
Black people are queuing up already. When is Wakanda starting? I want to. It was brilliant. I loved it. And I saw it in Plymouth. It was very funny. I went with my daughter in Plymouth to see the Black Panther. Very different experience.
I can imagine.
With a predominantly Cornwall audience. Well, I don't see what all the fuss is about. he's black and he's a panther. What's all the fuss about? It was really funny. Me and my daughter looking at each other like, we better not cheer too loudly.
Yeah. Just
but it was great. Ryan Coogler is a breakthrough. You know, anybody who gets anything of that magnitude on a big screen and gets, you know, $1 billion in revenue is obviously an outlier. Ava DuVernay, When They See Us. Mm. Did you see that? Oh, you do yourself a favor. You know, If Beale Street Could Talk, Moonlight.
Mm.
You know, these are extraordinary things. And what happens in what we're trying to do, you know, with Colourful Radio and with anything that's related to our culture is to just have the community come out and support it.
Yes.
And it's difficult because sometimes you don't feel supported. And I talk to lots of people who go, you know, you go and see, you know, if you go and see Stormzy at Glastonbury, who was in the audience? Not us.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I didn't see one, you know, there's one and two black people in the audience.
Mm.
And we don't like being at festivals anyway because there's mud and everything.
Exactly, it's not really us.
We don't like being jammed into confined spaces. Because any minute now, we think they're going to send us to the plantation. They got us in a confined space where there's mud and everything. Plantation next. We don't want that. So it's very difficult to get us to support that. And Stormzy must have been shocked when he walked out, you know, looking at the audience. But, you know, I think it's great that the dominant culture buy into things. I remember Jazzy B said, anything that's underground, the minute it goes overground, we just fall away. Because we're like, our work is done. Everybody likes it now. Let's find the next thing. Oh, you like jazz? We're moving on to bebop. Oh, you like bebop? We're going to do rock and roll. Oh, you like rock and roll? We're going to do funk. Oh, you like funk? We're going to do disco. Oh, you like disco? We're going to do techno. Oh, you like techno? We're going to do house. You know, we just keep moving on as a culture.
Well, we're very creative as well, aren't we? And it's like, we don't always create in order to monetize. And I think the problem is sometimes then the things that we've just created then get taken and then become monetized.
Well, I think anybody watching Ratman or Tyler Perry or Idris or any of those guys has to understand now that it's all about the business.
Yeah.
It's not just about creativity. Mm. Anybody creative in our industry has to understand you've got to learn or find somebody who understands what the business is. You know, Femi is not an idiot. Idris is not an idiot. They understand business. They can read a contract.
There you go.
They've got ideas about how to make a business work. And we got to support that. And we've also got to understand that we need to understand it too. I'm terrible at business. But I try and find people who can help me understand the contracts and understand what the deal is and what the revenue might be. Because you need to know that stuff.
Right.
The days have gone when we go, okay, I'll do anything. Because I just want to make a record. Those days are gone now.
No, it's very true.
We need to...
To be effective, we need the whole of it. We need to be the complete person. So we've got like 5 minutes left and I've got
5 minutes?
5 minutes. I know, it's gone so fast. 5 minutes. So we had a few questions in from the audience, and
I'm really glad you got them from, because my experience at the British Cultural Archive is that audiences can't really ask questions. Lenny, I see you on the TV, and you remind me of my father. Now, when he come to England, he was a good man. He was a firm man. He was a strong man. He had one and two job, and he did have a puppy. And
exactly.
You know, he could make rice so good, make you cry. Anyhow, he had a friend named One Finger, because him did have the one finger. And he was a decent man. He was a good man. He was a strong man. He could rattle. He was a man who could kill a cow with one hand. And make I tell you something else, Lenny. You see, when you go up on the TV, you remind me. We can't ask questions at all. So I'm so glad you've got the questions.
Yes, we got ahead of time. So, okay, I'm going to quick fire.
Who's on next on Colourful Radio? Who's the next person playing tunes?
Oh, well, it's Jazzy Q, and he's actually here at the back with
Jazzy
us.
Jazzy Q, right on.
Hello, Jazzy
Thank
Q.
you for playing Bootsy Collins. I'm a funketeer, so he's one of my favourites. Thank you, Jazzy Q.
Awesome.
Got the hat on indoors.
You got to do a David Bellamy impression for me soon.
Me grape nuts. Oh. Yeah, anyway, sorry, question from the audience.
Okay,
what's the first one?
First one is, have you done your DNA test? Any African in you? And that was done with tongue in cheek, because I know who did it, and he's very funny.
No, I haven't. When I was in South Africa, I was in Cape Town, a man talked to me for 25 minutes because he thought I was related to him. He was a bit drunk, but he was talking to me, and I really like you, man, but I know you look a bit like me, but we are not related. But then again, we might be. I won't go on who do you think you are.
Oh, really?
Well, because within 5 minutes, it's slavery, isn't it? And whoever it is, Trevor McDonald, Morris Stewart, within 5 minutes. And then when you find out, and then your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, she had slaves. Oh, Jesus Christ. You know, you don't want to be there, so I didn't want to do that.
Right, right, so you're avoiding that.
I don't want to give my family any more grief.
Right, I mean, I don't need to know
next question. Come with our next
thing. Okay, yes, what's next for you?
I want to do more acting. I mean, Doctor Who.
Yes!
Because the TARDIS is like a reggae record. It's like Lee Scratch Perry made a record, isn't it, the TARDIS? Why have we never had a black Doctor Who? They would rather have a dog do Doctor Who than a black person. Ow, ow, ow! What's that, Doctor Who? Ow, ow, ow! The Daleks are coming! Ow, ow! Okay! But there's not black people in Doctor Who. Have you noticed that?
I know. That is really
when Russell T. Davies, when Russell T. Davies was doing Doctor Who, there were so many black people in. I rang it up and said, there's too many black people in this show, you know. Put in some white people. It's getting embarrassing. Russell, you need more white people in the show to balance things out.
Okay.
So I'm in Doctor Who. That's going to be on New Year's Day.
Brilliant.
And I think it's called Spyfall. And I play a guy called Daniel Barton. And he's a tech guy like... Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos, and we don't know whose side he's on, but there's something going on. I'm so glad they didn't make me wear tentacles or anything. I'm just like a, and people were like, Len, you look cute in the the tuxedo, you know. So I get to wear a tuxedo and damn it, boom, damn it. I get to do a bit of that kind of acting.
Brilliant, can't wait.
And there's an Imagine on. I've done an Imagine with Alan Yentob.
Wow.
Based on the book, but we talk about stuff beyond the book too. Mm. So Imagine's on. I can't tell you the next big thing, but there is a big thing happening soon. But we're going to do more. We're going to go on tour again with the book.
So oh, wow.
I'm going to do a tour in New Zealand. And then there's going to be, I think we're going to do limited dates, maybe in Hackney, maybe in the Midlands, maybe in Salford. But we're going to do limited dates in the best venues.
Brilliant. But you see, you all have to buy tickets for the tour.
If you buy a ticket and come.
So you are right to come tonight. You didn't have to buy a ticket, so buy the book. So, okay, two quick questions. Who will win the general election?
Whoever it is, I hope they don't hide in a fridge. I hope they don't hide in our fridge. I don't know. But has everybody voted yet? You're going to vote? Make sure you do, you know, because you can't moan afterwards.
That's a good point.
You can't moan if you didn't vote. It's tough, man.
And you talk about your changes. Do you feel that you have now landed, or are there more changes to come?
There's more changes to come, because I think if you stand still, then you just end up digging a trench, you know, and a trench eventually becomes a grave. Don't get stuck in a rut. Keep moving. So I want to get better at acting. I want to do more theatre. There's talk of doing something at the National next year.
Fantastic.
I've got a production company, so of course we want to make more television. We've got lots of things on the horizon. It's good, but I'm not going to be complacent. There are still things to
talk about. There are still things in the public space to debate and to try and change. And I want to make things that my family can be proud of. That's all I want to do.
That is amazing.
And I think that if I can keep going and make my family proud, then I've done what I set out to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sir Lenny Henry.
Thank you.
This is Colourful Radio.
Thank you. Okay, so right now, thank you all for listening in to Jabber Talk on Colourful Radio.
This
but right
is
here,
Colourful Radio.
Awesome.